Hello, and welcome to Fundraising as a Female Founder, the podcast all about how to raise funds for your business as a woman. I'm your host, Alice Audley. With less than 1p in every pound of venture capital investment going to all female-founded companies, it's time to start asking some very hard questions about the fundraising landscape. On this podcast, I will speak to women who have either raised money, are raising money, are an angel, work in venture capital, or work within companies' investment teams, and get their views, advice, and lessons about how to successfully raise funds as a female founder. Who knows, I may speak to a couple of men who have invested in female-led companies too. So without further ado, you're listening to Fundraising as a Female Founder. I hope you enjoy the series.
I'm Claire Cherry. I'm an investment principal for True. True is a consumer-focused investment and innovation firm. So broadly, we actually have three arms to our business. I lead our early stage investment fund, which for us means investing at pre-seed through to Series A. Generally, investments of anywhere from £100,000 to about £2 million, and really supporting businesses, I guess, at that early stage of their fundraising journey. Outside of that, we also have a scale-up fund, which invests £20 to £60 million into more mature, generally profitable businesses. And finally, an innovation consultancy, which helps some of the names you might know, like Johnson & Johnson, Marks & Spencer's, John Lewis, broadly help with their digital transformation. So giving them access to tools, services, and brands that might be able to propel that business forward. So
is that within your portfolio that you give them access to?
Yeah, so for us, it's both about connecting portfolio companies to corporates, but also about connecting our wider ecosystem, really to be able to accelerate both sides of the business. So if you take one investment that we did, which is a good example of that, it's a business called Unmind, which is a mental health platform, but sold through corporates to sell into their employees. So when we first invested about 4 years ago, they had one client and we've helped accelerate that. So they probably now have north of 60 clients. They've just raised their Series B round. And a lot of that was because of the network that we'd built in serving that innovation pipeline for these corporates.
And how does that work exactly? That so you've invested in the businesses, is that just sort of a perk that you give them, or is it sort of in a way that you have capital in exchange for media sometimes? Is there a deal there to be had on that?
Yeah, so I guess it's more an upside of taking capital from us. So the way that we think about it from a portfolio perspective is really we invest in two types of businesses. So the first is consumer brands that we see as selling differentiated products into highly engaged communities. So things like Bleach London, which is a colour focused hair dye brand, all the way through to things like Unmind. And then the other side of the portfolio is more on the B2B side. So we've done things in virtual showrooming, in marketing technologies, and that, again, we provide value through accelerating them into corporates. So it's not necessarily a referral agreement or anything like that. It is an equity investment, but kind of upside of picking us as an investment partner.
What are the pitches and type of companies that you get most excited about?
Yeah, I think for me, because we're investing at a relatively early stage, you know, it is still very much about the team, the vision. I think I'm really inspired by founders that can take you on that journey, I guess, of problem, solution, sort of product market fit, and then all the way through to traction. I'd say one that sticks in my mind, actually a business that we did end up investing in, no surprise, is a business called Maud, which is a sexual wellness brand out of New York. I first met with Eva probably coming up 2 years ago, and really her vision for the business, the fact that her background led her to probably a decade of work around the industry, around the sector, to really create Maud as a brand. And I guess that comes through across all touch points. So because we are investing in consumer and it is sort of tangible, they have a social media presence, they have a brand and a tone of voice, you know, for us it is about understanding all elements of that and ultimately being able to see why a consumer would make a purchase from that brand over another brand. So
it definitely seems to be a big rise in sex products. And I was speaking to June Angelides for the podcast as well, and they'd invested in a sex wellness company as well. And then I met with the founders of Candid too, and I know that they'd done some stuff with Superdrug. So it's interesting. I think it's
it's funny
sign.
Because we actually looked at some probably just after I joined True about 5 years ago. And again, at the time, even when we did Maud, you know, coming up 2 years ago, it was sort of relatively taboo. But I agree, it seems to be the sort of last untouched area, I guess, of health and beauty. And I think a lot of the conversation going on around diversity and equality, you know, part of that does inherently come into the sexual health market and sex as an area for wellness.
Mm. When, I mean, competition is obviously a slide that comes up in investment decks, that market is becoming busier. How important, how do you stand out when there is competition? Like what makes someone stand out to you? I know you've mentioned team.
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of a number of things, but certainly for us, the single biggest thing aside from the team is sort of product quality. You know, we have to have something that, whether that's a tech product or a physical product, you know, for us it has to be something that delights, that consumers will continue to come back through, that the data is showing that you keep getting repeat purchases and you're not just paying for somebody who's then ultimately gonna fall away. So I think in terms of differentiation, probably that's the biggest thing that we see as differentiating most of our brands, is that ability to elevate the quality and I guess not be afraid of development timelines and cash intensity of building something that is truly differentiated rather than something that's me too. So all of our brands, they don't take products off the shelf that are, you know, already in existence and rename them or relabel them. It is kind of true ground up innovation. And then, you know, I think it is about market positioning. Ultimately, as new generations of consumers come through, now we're seeing, if we take sort of maybe fashion rental as an area, historically we had sort of Rent the Runway and others that were targeting the top end of the market, and now we're seeing some really exciting things come through focused more on Gen Z, serving clients through TikTok, you know, all of these good things. So yeah, I think because we only focus on one sector, we're quite granular in terms of what the market looks like and how we can segment that. But again, it's on the founders to understand that themselves and be able to articulate where they are and where they sit. You know, that's super exciting when founders can do that well.
Have you invested into the fashion rental space?
We haven't yet, no. We're looking at a couple at the moment. I think, again, sort of they're right on the cusp of where we look to invest in terms of sales and revenue. But I think we probably will end up investing in that area. Again, for us, we're really looking to back businesses that are at the sort of forefront of changing behaviours. And, you know, rental is a big area, the whole sustainability story. There's some super exciting things going on there.
Do you ever approach people to invest in them, or do you normally wait for people to come to you? So you see, for instance, the fashion rental space, do you approach them or?
It's probably 80-20. So a lot of the time it is referrals, either from other funds, other individuals. I would say that as a founder, don't underestimate sort of where introductions might come from, because, you know, we've had introductions from our compliance officer, from our lawyers, you know, it's all about networking and getting the name out there. And then, yeah, 20-30% of it is outbound research, I guess, particularly in something like rental or fashion resale, where we haven't done anything in the area, we really like the dynamics, we think there's a tailwind in the market, we would look to go after something there.
If you do get an introduction from someone and they have decided that they're not going to be investing themselves but have done the introduction, is that a negative?
Not necessarily. I think for us, and sort of one of the key pieces that is probably important for founders to realise, is, you know, every investment partner has to be the right fit for you as a business. So some businesses will tick all of our boxes. You know, if I go back to Maud, ever probably spent, what, 18 months raising her seed round and got a lot of no's from a lot of people who couldn't maybe invest in the sector, or it was too small, or whatever it might have been. But ultimately, I knew that it ticked all the criteria that we were looking for. And then I guess for every subsequent raise, it gets easier. So then they raised their Series A, actually from two beauty specific funds in the US earlier this year. But it is certainly not a turnoff for us. You know, we get a lot of things referred to from other investors, and 9 times out of 10 we'll still take a meeting and assess it from our perspective.
Do you tend to see that in the US, you've mentioned US funds, that they're writing bigger checks? And how often do the US and UK, you know, at seed level, how common is it to have sort of dual investment?
Yeah, so for us, it's been quite exciting, and I think probably surprised some people internally initially. But as you say, the US funds have started to write bigger and bigger investment checks. So for us, we have actually done probably now 5 or 6 deals over the last 18 months in the US, really, because there is fantastic businesses that, you know, maybe don't want to raise 5 to 10 million. They just want to raise 1 to 3. And ultimately, the funds, you know, don't want to do that from that perspective. And I think it's important to realise that a lot comes down to fund size. So for us, we intentionally run a small fund. So our fund is 50 million so that we can make smaller investments and they're still material. Whereas the US, you know, average fund size is probably 300 to 500 million. And ultimately, they've then got to see your business getting to that size on exit. So they're not necessarily going to make those investments at the seed and pre-seed level. But we are seeing, yeah, a lot more US funds come to the UK and vice versa. But probably at that later stage.
Do you lead? Are you known to lead investment rounds or do you tend to follow?
Yeah, so we are intentionally pretty flexible. So we've done both. I would say, you know, certainly as you're thinking about fundraising, it is very different dynamics to have even co-leading, which seems to be a big trend in the market at the moment, because I would often advise against it. I think ultimately it creates sort of a bit of a challenge around who is leading, who's taking responsibility when you down the line come to make decisions about strategy or hiring or whatever you might want board opinions on. You know, having a single point person to go to that who sort of in fronts the investor group will make your life much easier. And for us, you know, it's been, I guess, a different one because we're generally investing alongside funds who don't have consumer experience. So regardless of investment size, founders probably come to me above other people. So we've had to manage that internally about resource allocation and whether we should always look to lead rounds because, you know, people see us as the lead kind of whether we are or we aren't.
Yeah. And then when you have invested, you mentioned board, do you normally just take one board seat or?
Yeah, so normally we would take a board seat. And I guess for us, that's important in an ability to add value. So again, I think, you know, the beauty, I guess, if I look at the market at the moment is it is a founder first market at the moment. You know, there's a lot of capital, there's a lot of people raising funds, you know, we're sat on however many billions or trillions of savings post COVID. And a lot of that is going into whether it's crowdfunding or individual investing. So founders can afford to be picky. And I think if you think about the future and the success of the business, you are in bed with these people for 5 years, 10 years, you know, even in success, probably at least 3. So from that perspective, it is worthwhile understanding the value and the dynamics. And I guess for us, sort of a board seat is a bit of an epitome of that and driving that value forward.
What is the average that you are, say, in bed with a company? You know, is it...
I'd 6 or 7 years.
6 or 7 years. I have realised that we haven't really spoken much about you and your background. So I want to get back here. But at the beginning, you joined True 5 years ago. What were you doing before that? And how did you get into the world of VC?
Yeah, so I guess in terms of my background, it's, as many people will say, a relatively non-traditional route into investing. So, yeah, I joined True 5 years ago. Before that, I was at an early stage investment fund called Calculus. So again, we sort of did 3 to 5 million investment checks, but across all sectors. And for me, that was quite an important differentiation because ultimately, if I looked around, you know, the businesses where we had been able to add most value, where we had known the sector more, we could materially drive returns versus those where we probably didn't have experience. So I was actually a scientist by background, and sort of considered maybe going into a biotech or a healthcare fund, but ultimately didn't want to go back to university to do a doctorate or a master's. So you know, my second biggest passion was consumer, so I found myself you know, traipsing around the funds in London, which at the time there was probably a handful, a slightly more now, but yeah, and have loved it ever since. And yeah, really do think that an ability to understand the sector in which you're investing is so important. And even, you know, a lot of people ask me, should you go down the route of taking angel funding or should you go to an institutional fund? But for me, an angel who's had experience in your sector, who knows it well, who will be involved, is much more valuable than taking money from somebody who might write a bigger check but doesn't know the sector. You know, you'll just spend your time educating them or trying to get them up to speed on various things. And that's sort of perhaps not efficient for most people.
Yeah, you're after smart money.
Exactly.
Yeah. In terms of when you were at your previous fund and now at True, how many pitches would you say on average you see a month? Were they the same? Is that normal across funds or?
Yeah, so it's certainly high. So I'd say True is probably higher than Calculus. So for us, we're seeing probably somewhere between 2,500-3,000 businesses a year at True. And then Calculus is probably 1,500. I guess, given that we are solely focused on consumer, you know, we are probably the go-to place for most people raising money in that sector in the UK, which is fantastic. But it does mean that, you know, efficiency is the name of the game. And that probably comes down to a topic that we're going to touch on around pitch decks and what to include, and that, you know, the ultimate reality of it is the numbers that we see, I don't think are unique in a venture fund at all. And therefore, you just can't dedicate half an hour to reading a pitch deck as much as I'd like to do that.
Yeah. So you get, say, 3,000 a year. And then that's split between the whole fund, though, so not necessarily at pre-seed, seed, that's sort of...
Yeah, exactly. So I guess it's everything from pre-seed all the way through to Series A.
Did you see during... I know we're still in the pandemic, but during the worst bits of the pandemic, that the amount of pitches reduced, or did you see more? And actually, did it change efficiency and that you were doing video calls with founders as opposed to meeting in person?
Yeah, so for us, I'd say sort of at the very cusp of the first lockdown, we certainly saw a reduction, both in terms of people looking to raise money and also in terms of other funds. Maybe we've invested through the whole period, but certainly a lot of funds probably took a 6-month breather really to focus on existing portfolio to see how it was all going to play out. I think following that, it's increased dramatically. You know, I would say the last 2-3 months is probably the busiest we've ever been in terms of new deals. But equally, I do think part of that is a lot of the e-commerce businesses saw fantastic trading over the last 12 months, you know, really probably stepped into their stride and got those numbers up. So from that perspective, I'm not entirely surprised. But I do think that, yes, there's a lot of deal flow out there at the moment. And that has meant we've had to be more efficient. So yes, probably changing initial meetings to a call and a video call, which works really well. I think, you know, we don't want to waste founders' time and vice versa. If it's not going to be a fit for us, then a half hour call or 45 minutes is better than making entrepreneur trek across London or into London to coordinate pitch meetings. So, you know, it does work well.
You've mentioned Eva and Maud. Out of the pitches that you see, what percentages would you say are with female founders, either, you know, sole female founders or?
Yeah, so we're pleased to say, and I guess perhaps a function of the fact that the early stage fund is entirely female within True, so that helps. But about 60% of our portfolio have a female founder. I'd say in terms of pitches, it's probably 60-40 the other way, but I think that's a testament to, you know, fantastic female founders that they actually over-index in terms of the deal flow that we get through to investment.
Mm. What do you think that we can do? I mean, it sounds like that. I mean, those numbers are much higher than any others that I've heard. But what do you think can be done to encourage female founders? Do you think that it's more, you know, back into education, and that many women feel that it's not really, they're not able to go and raise money? They're more inclined to use their own and don't really feel that VCs are a way for them to go.
Yeah, completely. I think it does start in education. I guess even if I look at my own background, you know, I sort of fell into investing, to be honest. It was a 6-week placement that ended up being, you know, a decade later. So from that perspective, I can't say that it was ever sort of an education piece. And, you know, the challenge around getting more female founders, more funding to female-focused businesses, also ultimately rests with more female investors. You know, still there is a distinct lack of female partners across investment firms, and I guess the battle has to be fought on both sides. So, you know, a lot of what I do is educating graduates and speaking at as many events as possible, really to improve that investor side. And then I think there are some great networks popping up. You know, I'm part of Alma Angels, which is supporting female founders all the way through to C, which again is resources for female entrepreneurs. But I spoke to an interesting fund the other day, and really a lot of what they invest in is enabling women the freedom to pursue their passion. So whether that be more efficient home life, more efficient work life. And I think part of it is also those tools that give women an ability to start something that maybe they otherwise wouldn't have had the confidence to do. And, you know, I think men are much more well-versed in taking the leap and, you know, much more risk takers than women. And that's another area that we certainly need to bridge the gap.
Mm. We've mentioned pitch decks, and we've also mentioned your time and to be able to look over them, so you can't, you know, allocate lots and lots of time to a pitch deck. So how many pages should a pitch deck be in your view, and what needs to be on it? Do you want graphics, visuals, bullet points? You know, what's a big no-no with a pitch deck too?
I think there's certainly, the bar has been raised since I first got into the industry, that's for sure. I think, you know, back in the day, having a mediocre pitch deck probably would have still secured you funding, whereas now, you know, certainly I would expect it to look beautiful as much as have fantastic content. I think certainly a pet hate of mine and something to avoid is far too many slides. You know, if you're sending me 40 to 60 slides, is just too much, and it from my perspective shows you don't have an ability to present your business concisely, which is a challenge in itself. So I'd say sort of somewhere between 10 and 20 is perfectly sufficient, not too text heavy, you know, really easy to digest, containing all the right information. So there's also a trend at the moment not to include any sort of, you know, KPIs or trend growth, whether that be the softer side. So if we think about engagement or social stats, all the way through to revenue, if you have it, or customers, and all that's going to result is in me asking that you for that information, or not including information about the funding round. You know, all of those pieces you do have to cement before you go out.
Why is there a trend of people not including?
I think it's because they think if they don't say it, they're likely to get a meeting and then more likely to go down that path of investment. But ultimately, yes, you might do that, but then the fund will still, when they look at it, decide. You know, it is a part of every single investor's view on sort of where they like to invest, what the metrics might be. So, yeah, I'm not sure it's necessarily productive to do it, but certainly it feels more and more like it is happening.
Not mentioning business names or individuals' names, but what in your years of VC has been the worst in-person pitch you've had, and why?
So my pet hate, and I think people are different on this front, so do take it with a pinch of salt, is if you've already sent me your deck in advance, and then when we get to a meeting, you will not diverge from going through the deck again. You know, if I'm asking questions, for me, it's much more beneficial to have an open conversation rather than say, yep, that's coming up on slide 5, or you'll see that on slide 10, we'll get to that. You know, it just really breaks what could become quite an organic conversation where you get into the depths of things, because, you know, investors will want to dive into different areas. And I think the more that you cement that as a regimented structure, the harder it is. And then the other challenge is people with just crazy expectations of what they think they're going to achieve. You know, so if I speak to a founder, and no matter how good you are, if you tell me you're going to be at 300 million of profit in 2 years, it's just very, very hard for me to take that credibly when you're at virtually zero today. So yeah, it's
out of
about
the people that have said that, you know, gone in with those expectations, what's the percentage of women versus men that have given you?
Oh yeah, 100% men. Yeah. as you'd expect.
Yeah, I like that. So then the best pitches, and you know, that's where we're going to be, which links in, I suppose, to valuation. If they're saying they're going to be doing 300 million, then their valuation's going to, you know, very high indeed. What is a realistic way to get to a valuation, do you think? What would, if someone came to you and said, this is the value, what would make you believe that that is the value?
Yeah, so I think for us, it's sort of a triangulation of, you know, where the business is today, what it's achieved, sort of what success looks like. How are we going to get, you know, to the 3 years or the 5 years or however far ahead you might be looking at? And what will be required to get there? You know, part of a valuation is a function of how much future capital you're going to have to raise. So for some of our businesses, you know, we might be able to accept a slightly higher valuation now because we don't think we're going to be diluted down in future from additional funding rounds. Partly it is a function of even just looking forward the next 6 months, the next 12 months, you know, if you're onboarding new clients or if you have great press stories coming out. A fundraising process is all about building that momentum through that period to show that you can justify that price. And, you know, I would say that there's certainly a caution around valuation. Obviously, given it's a founder-friendly market, valuations are probably as high as I've ever seen them. But equally, yes, it might feel like a win to get a really high valuation now, but the expectations that you're putting on yourself from that investor base can be crippling at times because you've always got to grow into higher and higher prices and larger funding rounds. So it's, you know, something that I would say you should think very hard and about before you take money from investors is really, you know, we see a lot where you could do a crowdfund or you could raise from an individual at a higher price than we're willing to pay. And, you know, part of that is because we have more benchmarks, we see more businesses, we know what the market are paying. But do you want that, or do you want the value that we might be able to bring in terms of systems, processes, recruitment, strategy? You know, it all comes in the round. The price isn't necessarily the only consideration when taking funding.
What stake do you tend to take in businesses?
It varies wildly, and we actually don't set any sort of hurdle because we do, you know, our smaller businesses are pre-revenue, they haven't launched. We have a business called Planera. It's creating the world's first flushable sanitary pad. So they have a patent around the technology, but ultimately they haven't scaled to commercial production yet. So they open their web shop for an hour or two every month, sell out of their full production and then go forward. So valuing it off sales or profit is sort of, you know, irrelevant at that point in time. So we'd have, I guess, a different stake in that to something where, you know, they're generating 5 or 6 million of sales and are much more established. So yeah, we I'd say on average it's 30% would be our maximum, but it's all the way to sort of low single digits percentage.
Because you want to still have the founder incentivized, I guess that's why you wouldn't go higher.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. You know, for us, I think, again, because there's quite a tendency to raise capital earlier now, and there are more funds, more angel networks, more individuals willing to take that risk. Ultimately, we're actually looking at one investment at the moment where I think we will have to top up the founder with options because, you know, it's a single founder and they don't have enough equity really for us to truly get behind it. And I think certainly when you consider things like co-founders, it's a very important point that everybody has to be equally remunerated, plus key employees, plus investors. You know, there's quite a lot to go around.
Okay, so going back to then the chain of from start to finish, you've been emailed a pitch, you like it, you meet the founder, that goes very well. Then what happens? But you know, what's this process from there? You've got your due diligence, but before the cash actually goes into the company, and what time frame is the shortest time frame you've done that in?
Yeah, so typically we would look to meet the founder, probably some of the senior team, over the course of, you know, a week, 10 days. I guess once we've done that, we've got comfortable, we've got all the information. You know, part of it is how ready the company is. For those that maybe have fundraised before, they have a data room, it's all there. It's very quick from our perspective. So it could be as quick as a week, 10 days to come to an investment decision. And again, our process sort of depends on the stage of the business. For us, if it's early stage, we're putting in, you know, 100,000 to 200,000, we probably could go start to finish in 2-3 weeks. I guess for those where, you know, we're putting in 1 to 2 million, they're more mature, there's more data to go through, there's more to understand, probably 6 to 8 weeks on average. And I guess for us, so I guess it's all the internal work we do, meeting management, going to their site, customer referencing, then we take it to our investment committee, they sign off, and then we do some formal due diligence. So again, that can encompass anything from legal reviews, financial reviews, operational, management, digital marketing. You know, we probably pick 2 or 3 of those that we think are most applicable for the business as it stands, and that will be a period of sort of 3 weeks maybe with external advisors crawling all over it and meeting management, and then through to completion.
What would you say to a business that was doing pretty well before COVID and then has been impacted but needs to raise now, you know, in terms of, would you look forgivingly on that, or would you tell them to try and organically get back to where they were before raising?
Yeah, so for us as a fund, it's challenging. I guess we typically invest in businesses that are in growth, and that includes kind of, you know, the very strange world that was 2020 and, you know, inherently 2021 as well. But yeah, I think it's both about seeing how far you can get with other sources of funding. So whether that be, you know, we see quite a lot of sort of non-dilutive funding, whether it's the revenue-based financing providers, the Clearcos, the Uncaps of the world, they can get you to a certain point, all the way through to really just thinking about how you shape your story. So, you know, yes, you might have had a sales dip, or you might not have onboarded the customers that you thought you were going to onboard. But what has happened? Are there positive things that you can pick out from that? Have you scaled a community? Have you grown offline? Have you been able to activate in real world events? Have you massively accelerated your digital proposition? You know, all of those pieces, I guess, help an investor get comfortable. And it's not to say that, I'd say we're probably the exception, that we're not looking from that perspective, but a lot of funds are. They see it as a massive opportunity, really, perhaps to get in with a business that they love and have known for a while, perhaps at a more reasonable price than they might have done otherwise. So, but yeah, my overriding guidance would be to sort of raise from a position of strength as much as possible.
And you mentioned that you are a bit wary of co-leading rounds with sort of two funds. What about investing alongside sort of institutional strategic invest, like a bigger business?
Yeah, so we've seen that more and more for sure. So when we did Shameless Pets, which is a business which takes the waste from human food production and turns it into nutritious dog treats, they had a strategic investor on their cap table when we came in, and it was small, sort of less than 5%, but it was a long conversation that we had internally around whether it's something that we can get comfortable on. Whereas now I would say sort of 18 months on, you know, there's two that we're looking at the moment that both will be led by strategic investors. I think, again, for us, the view on that hasn't changed. You know, it depends a lot on how they structure it, whether it is a venture arm or whether it is the corporate, you know, what their expectations are over acquisition, because that's the biggest piece that, you know, we want to keep all avenues open. But and I do think, you know, some businesses will get it right, some businesses will get it wrong, but it's about keeping the financial side open if you wanted, and that's the most important thing for us.
Yeah. So not giving any rights away on exit that they don't get first dibs, something like that.
Exactly. And even if it's not as formal as that, you know, an ability to sort of appoint a lot of board directors, you know, there's a lot of things that would be sort of red flags for us from that side of things. So yeah, broadly we try to mirror as close as possible what we have as terms. And the interesting thing is, as we're giving advice to some of our corporate partners on that side, ultimately it's sort of incomprehensible for them to move that mindset, because realistically for them, everything they invest in will be an ultimate acquisition, because when they go in, they're really excited about it. And it, for us, it was like, okay, but come a year's time, you might not be really excited about it and it might not have done what you wanted. And you are absolutely preventing anybody else from coming into that business. Yeah. So most of them are pretty sensible these days. But I do think that, you know, it's sort of is insane to me that all of these guys who generate multiple billions in, you know, cash every year and looking at businesses that turn over 1 or 2 million, like, it's a completely different mindset, completely different ball game. So we try to keep them sort of relatively arm's length for the first few years, just while the businesses are getting onto their feet, because, you know, there are ups and downs, there's good months, there's bad months, that's the nature of early stage investing, and for them, they're probably not used to that 9 times out of 10.
You mentioned that you're invested in Unmind, and that's workplace mental health. I think sometimes the mental health of founders doesn't get talked about enough when they're going through the pressure. You know, what support is in place, would you say, for founders? And do you feel that people can come to you or would to talk about things like that over the pandemic and things?
Yeah, so it's certainly a significant challenge, I think, and particularly for single founders, you know. Actually, one of the longest conversations we have is around businesses with single founders, for that very reason, in that it's very lonely there. And if they don't have a good support network around them, then that can be challenging. You know, for us as a fund,
is that a red flag, would you say?
Not necessarily. I think we would just, you know, part of the work that we do pre-investment is to understand how we can provide that guidance, provide that support network. So if it was a single founder, we would say, okay, we want you to get an independent non-exec or advisor who you can call on a weekly basis and just chat through anything and everything, because you will come across things even that you don't want to discuss with us, not from a personal perspective, maybe from a business perspective. Yeah. Where you want an independent view. And then equally, we've started a Slack channel with all of our portfolio founders, and broadly that gives them ability to chat to each other, and that's been fantastic from that perspective, because, you know, take the Facebook algorithm changes when Apple updated their privacy update. From that side, everyone's running around panicking, like, is this the end of being able to sell products to people through Facebook? Of course not. And all it takes is, you know, a quick exchange of messages for them to all feel a bit more comfortable. So yeah, that there are things out there, but I think certainly for us, we look to do as much as possible, I guess, particularly across our portfolio, really to drive that stability and, you know, providing a bit of an anchor in what can be relatively tumultuous seas.
Yeah. And finally, we've spoken that there's a lot of money that's out there ready to be invested in businesses. What type of business are you most excited to see moving forward to 2022? And are there any trends that you think that we'll see?
Yeah, so I think for us, certainly the overarching piece that we're most excited about is sort of the rise of sustainable consumerism and all of that piece. So again, the side around rental, resale and fashion We're looking at a sustainable beauty brand that's sort of all plastic free, fully compostable. And for us, that I think that has been a step change over the last 12 months as people have just taken their foot off the gas and really evaluated those purchase decisions. And then again, it can be anything really. From we're looking at businesses obviously in sort of quick commerce and, you know, dark kitchens and being able to serve hyper local communities. So yeah, I don't think there's any hard and fast piece, and no doubt things will come across my desk that I never will have spoken about. That will be super exciting. You know, we've looked at a lot in women's health around the menopause, fertility. Obviously, we did Planera, but again, you know, I'm just very excited that I think that the pandemic has created a catalyst for people to pursue their passions, to pursue businesses outside of, you know, the corporate world. So for us, it's sort of a very fertile ground for exciting ideas to appear. And yeah, we've seen that happening already, which has been great.
You've been listening to Fundraising as a Female Founder with me, Alice Audley. If you have any questions, suggestions for future guests, or want to get in touch, please contact me through my new website, aliceaudley.com, or tweet me at Alice Audley. That's AUDLEY.